While the debates over who will be number 45 are through, we remember number 38. And we're saying so long to 2015. Lots of numbers on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The Democratic candidates debated for the last time this year on Saturday night. What's the verdict?
Clinton punched back. She'd done her homework, as we usually expect her to. But it almost seemed as if Sanders and O'Malley helped push her, at least in tone, as the more centrist, which probably will help her in the general.
And with the New Hampshire primary just about 6 weeks away, who's leading in the Granite State?
Rubio, a lot of people say, oh, he's everybody's second choice and some people's first choice, but it is unclear if he's put in the time to win people over.
Plus, we remember former President Gerald Ford.
Ford came into office, and there was what you could only call euphoria. And it wasn't necessarily for anything that Ford had done. It was simply because Americans were glad to have Watergate behind them.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
And like to you, and link to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 108 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. So who was the winner in Saturday night's Democratic debate? We kind of know who was the most talked about.
We will rise to the challenge of ISIL, and we will rise together to the challenges that we face in our economy, but we will only do so if we hold true to the values and the freedoms that unite us, which means we must never surrender them to terrorists, must never surrender our American values to racists, must never surrender them to the fascist pleas of billionaires with big mouths. We are a better country than this. Our enduring symbol is not the barbed wire fence. It is the Statue of Liberty, and America's best days are in front of us if we move forward together.
And just in case you don't know who Martin O'Malley was referring to,
I worry greatly that the rhetoric coming from the Republicans, particularly Donald Trump, is sending a message to Muslims here in the United States and literally around the world that there is a clash of civilizations, that there is some kind of Western plot or even war against Islam.
And the next day on ABC's This Week, Bernie Sanders chipped in.
What somebody like a Donald Trump is doing is playing on the fears and anxieties of the American people. And people are afraid. They're afraid of terrorism, rightfully so. They're anxious about an economy in which the middle class is disappearing. We're seeing massive levels of income and wealth inequality. People are worried about the future for their kids. These are legitimate fears. So instead of having a rational discussion about how we rebuild the middle class, how we deal with Wall Street, how we have a tax system in which the wealthy and powerful start paying their fair share of taxes, what Trump is saying is, it's all the Muslims' fault. It's all the Mexicans' fault.
Even Vladimir Putin got into the act this week, calling Trump a very bright and talented man. A proud moment for the GOP frontrunner, who said as much Sunday talking with ABC's George Stephanopoulos on This Week.
If Putin respects me and if Putin wants to call me brilliant and other things that he said, which were frankly very nice, I'll accept that. And I'll accept it on behalf of our country. Because if we get along well with Russia, that's a positive thing, George, not a negative thing.
Stephanopoulos tried his hardest to make sense of it all.
One final question about Vladimir Putin. When you were pressed about his killing of journalists, you said, I think our country does plenty of killing, too. What were you thinking about there? What killing sanctioned by the U.S. government is like killing journalists?
Well, I think, number one, I think Hillary, when she was Secretary of State, made some horrible, horrible decisions, and thousands and even hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. I mean, you look at what went on in Libya. You look at so many bad decisions that she made. She's incompetent, as far as I'm concerned.
That's
you
not
look at
killing
her rage,
by the United States government, though, is it? That's not the same as ordering a killing.
As far as the reporters are concerned, obviously, I don't want that to happen. I think it's horrible. But in all fairness to Putin, you're saying he killed people. I haven't seen that. I don't know that he has. Have you been able to prove that? Do you know the names of the reporters that he's killed? Because I've been, you know, you've been hearing this, but I haven't seen the name. Now, I think it would be despicable if that took place, but I haven't seen any evidence that he killed anybody in terms of reporters.
So Donald Trump doesn't think Putin is a murderer because he hasn't seen proof. But ask him for proof about Muslims celebrating in Jersey City after 9/11, and he'll say he knows it's true because his followers on Twitter agree with him. Meanwhile, a new Washington Post ABC News poll shows that 59% of Republicans agree with Trump's proposal to ban Muslims from coming into the U.S. That compares to 15% of Democrats, 38% of independents, and 36% overall. One candidate who made it clear that what Trump was presenting was unacceptable is out of the race. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, whose campaign never went anywhere and who was from the beginning relegated to the undercard debate, ended his bid on Monday.
I got into this race to put forward a plan to win a war we cannot afford to lose and to turn back the tide of isolationism that was rising in our party. I believe we made enormous progress in this effort. 4 months ago, at the very first debate, I said that any candidate who did not understand that we need more American troops on the ground in Iraq and Syria to defeat ISIL was not ready to be commander-in-chief. At that time, no one stepped forward to join me. Today, most of my fellow candidates have come to recognize this is what's needed to secure our homeland.
In the end, Graham withdrawing may be like the proverbial tree in the forest. But he had a point of view worth debating, and now he's gone. Meanwhile, it's now less than 6 weeks until Iowa. And speaking of Iowa, Governor Terry Branstad has become the longest-serving governor in the history of the nation. The website Smart Politics noted that he has served nearly 21 years in office, or 7,642 days and counting. He passed the record held by Clinton, George Clinton, that is, who was governor of New York from 1777 to 1798. Well, back in third place is Bill Janklow of South Dakota, Alabama's George Wallace is fourth, and there's a tie for fifth between Jim Hunt of North Carolina and Jim Rhodes of Ohio. The only other current governor in the top 20 is Jerry Brown of California. In his fourth and presumably final term, Brown is number 19 on the list. For the record, Edwin Edwards of Louisiana, who is in seventh place, is the longest-serving governor ever to appear as a guest on The Political Junkie. And I can tell you that you know we're leading to this week's trivia question. John Dingell, the Michigan Democrat who retired last year, served in the House longer than anyone else. But who was the longest-serving House Republican of all time? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to our last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Those oldies but goodies reminds me of you. The songs of the past bring back memories of you. I always remember the first night we met. The songs they were playing, I never will forget.
The three Democratic presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley, debated on Saturday night, the second time in a row that they've debated on a Saturday night. There are some who see a conspiracy in this, that the Democratic National Committee, in cahoots with the Clinton campaign, is hosting these debates at a time when TV viewership is at its lowest. That's the theory of the Sanders campaign and the O'Malley campaign. Regardless, it was a spirited and sometimes heated debate. Abby Livingston is the Washington bureau chief of the Texas Tribune. She also worked at Roll Call, CNN, The Hotline, and NBC News. She knows her politics. And she's watching the race for 2016 very closely. Abby, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Thank you for having me.
What's the Abby Livingston scorecard for Saturday's debate? You know, who impressed you and what, if anything, changed in the battle for the nomination?
It's a relatively stable campaign coming out of the debate from where we entered it. Secretary Clinton, she was the center point of focus, and she didn't have any major stumbles. There are some issues in which she discussed Donald Trump and ISIS videos, and her team has had to walk that back. Senator Sanders seemed to score the points he wanted to score, and Martin O'Malley struggled, just as he is in the polls, and he struggled for relevancy, and there's been some pretty negative articles written about him since then. So I don't know if we've changed too much from where we entered it, but what I was so interested in is how Clinton handles herself and how she punched back. She'd done her homework, as we usually expect her to. But in some ways, assuming she is the general election nominee, it almost seemed as if Sanders and O'Malley helped push her, as at least in tone, as the more centrist, which probably will help her in the general.
There were two reactions to that. If both Clinton and Sanders had the kind of debate performance they wanted, and if Hillary Clinton goes into the debate with a huge lead, then she comes out of the debate with a huge lead. Nothing changes, right?
I would think so. And I'm watching this from a different view, I feel like, than a lot of the coverage. And what we have is Clinton is in very strong shape in Iowa, and Sanders is in strong shape in New Hampshire. And I think if Sanders' surge had happened later, we would have been fairly shocked, and it would have been seen as a huge defeat for Clinton to lose New Hampshire if that's what happens. But we've kind of had, in the political world, a chance to kind of settle into that notion that Sanders might win. So I don't think it's as huge of a blow as it would have been maybe if this was surging at this point. But I'm still fascinated with what happens after New Hampshire. We're going to have a whole bunch of primaries, and we'll see if Bernie Sanders has the infrastructure to take on Clinton. So looking beyond the debate and looking beyond on how things are, the Clintons have a very formidable infrastructure when it comes to superdelegates and the campaign. So, I'm just going to be fascinated. I don't see this debate having reset the table on any front, but I think Sanders' supporters came out energized, but I also think Clinton's probably did too.
This seems to be really caught in the weeds here, but going into the debate, the most important issue in the world, at least regarding cable TV and the rest of the media, it made it seem like that anyway, was regarding the charges that a Sanders campaign worker inappropriately accessed voter files and other data held by the Clinton campaign. Everybody was talking about it. It was on all the headlines. Explain to the lay person what that was all about.
Well, and I will explain it as a lay person, because all I wanted to do is I heard this is go to one of these political parties and learn how the data system works, because it's very insider ball with the technology community. But essentially, campaigns funnel their data to the national party, the DNC, and the DNC keeps track of it and cultures it for the general election campaign, and a firewall was taken down for a few minutes on Wednesday, and some Bernie Sanders staffers stumbled into the Clinton data. There are disputes on what they saw, but the Clinton campaign charges that they basically saw the secret sauce of the Hillary Clinton campaign and were very angry. DNC Chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz suspended Sanders' campaign from access to these files, including their own. Sanders himself apologized on the stage, but then they used that to charge DNC Chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz for favoritism, which has been a charge that's been going on all year long. So it was a very hot fight. It seemed to be put out fairly quickly, but it was extremely charged. There was a lot of emotion on both sides, and it didn't feel as manufactured as a lot of these spats that we see on the campaign trail. So what I'm curious to watch from all of this is if this is a long-standing thing, if this is a signal of the intensity to come, or if this is something that we're going to have a hard time remembering 2 weeks from now.
Well, I suspect it's the latter. I mean, as we said, they went into the debate with this being a seemingly big deal, and then it seemed to go away with a Sanders apology. Here's debate moderator David Muir of ABC News.
Does Secretary Clinton deserve an apology tonight?
Yes, I apologize.
Secretary Clinton, do you accept?
No. Not only do I apologize to Secretary Clinton, and I hope we can work together on an independent investigation from day one, I want to apologize to my supporters. This is not the type of campaign that we run. And if I find anybody else involved in this, they will also be fired.
And that was that.
We saw something similar when Senator Sanders put to rest the Hillary Clinton email issue in the first debate. They did serve in the Senate together, and so there doesn't seem to be animosity or when they have an issue, their campaigns fight it out, and then once they get on the stage, it sort of peters out, and they seem to move on and want to talk about the issues, which is fascinating, and it's a little just kind of encouraging about politics in some ways. But then Martin O'Malley immediately interjected and was accusing them of bickering, and it was a little off for what the tone of Clinton and Sanders was.
We're going to get to the Republicans in a second, but you mentioned, and I agree with you, that foreign policy is perhaps Hillary Clinton a stronger suit more so than Sanders or O'Malley. But at one point, Hillary Clinton said during the debate that ISIS was using Donald Trump's comments about Muslims in its recruiting videos. But no one has ever seen such a video. Donald Trump called her a liar. And you know how Donald Trump feels about the accuracy of making charges. But it seemed to be a, I don't know if it was a misstep, but something Hillary Clinton didn't need to get involved in.
Correct. And that's been the main fallout of this debate for her. And her staff has spent a few days trying to walk that back.
Clinton and Sanders also not only battled over foreign policy, but they continued their battle over the banks, about Wall Street. And that seems obviously that's the big domestic difference between the two.
Yeah, and it was interesting because Clinton really returned fire, of all people, to Martin O'Malley and reminded the world that he raised money from Wall Street when he was chairman of the Democratic Governors Association. And so it's a good charge for Sanders to throw at her, and it definitely energizes his base. People from New York State tend to fundraise from Wall Street, and that was her big misstep at the last debate was
Invoking
9/11, and that, a lot of people interpreted that as an unsavory tactic. You know, I think it's an effective charge for Sanders, and it helps energize his people, and I think he's very sincere when he criticizes her for that.
I thought it was interesting to watch O'Malley. I mean, this was a different O'Malley. Well, of course, he's been mired in very low single digits throughout the campaign, but I noticed there was a lot of interrupting, a lot of insisting that he gets his answers in, whether he was called on or not. I thought it was not a great moment for Martin O'Malley.
It's a difficult spot for him. He just has not broken through. I think that the interesting thing is often with these debates, it's not really how much you get to speak, because the viewership was not that great. It was a Saturday night. But if you get that one moment, that one 20-second clip that is re-aired over and over and over for a week, that to me as a politician would be the one that I would most value. And Joe Biden had several of those when he ran for president in 2008. And so I don't know if it's necessarily as effective to be interrupting, but just to have the memorable line that everyone remembers rather than just, you know, trying to inject yourself.
And O'Malley showed no hesitation in going after both Sanders and Clinton. Here's some tape.
Senator Sanders voted against the Brady Bill. Senator Sanders voted to give immunity to gun dealers. And Senator Sanders voted against even research dollars to look into this public health issue. Secretary Clinton changes her position on this every election year, it seems, having one position in 2000 and then campaigning against President Obama and saying we don't need federal standards. Look, what we need on this issue is not more polls. We need more principle.
I would think that all this would rule out a Clinton O'Malley or a Sanders O'Malley ticket.
That's what has surprised me with O'Malley is how strong his language was. And he's called Hillary Clinton several times shameful.
The last Republican debate was about a week ago, so I know it's old news by now, but did anything stand out for you?
I think that, and we've seen an extension of it for days going forward, is the Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz jostling. And so I don't know where this is going, and the Rubio people have been relentless on Cruz and hitting him from the right on foreign policy and taking apart his record and trying to make him look not genuine. And Cruz is a very effective communicator, so I don't know if any of this will be working. It is also the week before Christmas when very few people are paying attention to politics. So I have a geographic bias and interest in Ted Cruz, and so that is definitely what jumped out at me.
I also thought that Rubio, I mean, after very strong debate performances, I thought that Rubio was on either the defensive over his role with the Gang of Eight regarding immigration overhaul, but he was under assault. It seems like the choice for the non-Trump voter, Republican voter, seems to be Cruz versus Rubio.
I think so, and we do hear that Chris Christie has gained some traction in New Hampshire, and Jeb Bush is supposedly going to amp up his attacks on Trump, and it's an interesting spot where we are. I think it's extremely unpredictable. I do think Ted Cruz has a very good field operation all over this country, and I just don't know the others as well, but his is an exceptional organization. So we will, I think it is all very unpredictable right now.
And 6 weeks to go before Iowa, he apparently has a lead, or at least in the latest polls in the Hawkeye State.
Yes, and I was with him when the first poll came out showing he was in the lead there. We were actually in South Carolina, but he is running, of all people, a very Barack Obama-like campaign, and he will say that. And what I mean by that is he studied Barack Obama's 2008 campaign when everyone counted him out, and in the organization and the tactics, and the Cruz folks were very unconcerned about any urgency about breaking through. The later, the better for them. So I don't know if this was the exact moment they wanted to break through in Iowa, but they were very much watching it. This was not something, a headline they wanted in August. And so it is going to be very interesting to see if the other campaigns can compete with him on a structural level.
Abby, you don't get off the show without having to answer this question. If you had to name the two-party nominees today, who would they be?
Oh, wow.
Say, come on. We're paying you big money to be on the show.
There you go. Well, I will certainly eat all of my crow, but I think at this point I would probably go with Hillary Clinton and Ted Cruz.
Abby Livingston is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Texas Tribune, and I reckon she can be found on Twitter at TexasTribAbby. Texas Trib Abby, it was great having you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
We've spent much of the show so far talking about the Democratic debate in New Hampshire. Now it's time to talk about what's happening on the ground in the Granite State. For that, we go to Josh Rogers, the senior political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. Josh, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Good to be here, Ken.
There's a new CBS News poll out that has Bernie Sanders up 56-42 over Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire, with Martin O'Malley way back in low single digits. Does that pretty much conform with what you're seeing?
Well, Sanders has been up in most of the recent polls. I think he's been up by an average of about 8. Certainly, his campaign has a lot of grassroots support, a lot of excitement among volunteers and activists. For him, Hillary Clinton has been kind of steady as she goes here for some time. She has experienced people running her campaign. They're confident that they have the apparatus that's going to be able to turn out the vote for her. O'Malley, as has been the case for some time, has sort of struggled to get any attention whatsoever. You know, New Hampshire was seen as a place where it was going to be a strong place for Hillary Clinton. Right now, it looks like the place where she's going to be, the most tested, perhaps, in the early states.
She has the big endorsements. She has Governor Hassan, Senator Shaheen. She has 7 weeks to overcome Sanders. Can she be the comeback kid?
I think that's possible. Her people would say that they believe that the focus on national security will ultimately, help her when people actually have to make their decision. Voters here, while a lot of people in the Democratic primary are fairly committed as to who they're going to vote, there's going to be a certain number of people who may change their minds. We have, unenrolled or independent voters, or, people who are not members of either party who are going to be voting. How they break could make a difference in the Democratic race. It looks tight, but you would say that Clinton's campaign has more practiced hands. That may or may not make any difference, but her campaign is confident that their methodical approach and the organization that they've been building since the summer, and they've been building one since well before Bernie Sanders picked up some steam here, is going to do the job for them.
Regional candidates have a history of doing well in New Hampshire. John Kerry, Paul Tsongas, Michael Dukakis. But Sanders' strength is more than just being a neighbor, right?
Certainly part of it is being a neighbor, but part of it is speaking to the wishes of a lot of people in the Democratic Party here. A lot of people in the Democratic Party here are more liberal on economic issues than Hillary Clinton. And a good segment of those people are very excited for Bernie Sanders. It's hard to know. Bill Clinton obviously came in second here and claimed victory. She obviously came back after losing the caucuses to then-Senator Obama.
In 2008, right?
In 2008, and people, it was kind of almost a death watch for her campaign, but she managed to pull it out. And, she has a core of committed supporters. A lot of people think that her ability to mobilize women voters, may help her. There's certainly the generation of the top leaders in the Democratic Party. There are a lot of, women of middle age and older who really identify with Hillary Clinton. Her campaign thinks that those folks are going to be a selling point. But there's certainly a lot of excitement for Bernie Sanders, excitement that I think few people predicted. I mean, I was personally skeptical. A lot of the people working for Clinton thought it would have ebbed by now. But, you know, the Sanders campaign is feeling pretty good about its chances.
She has a small lead in Iowa. She has a huge lead in South Carolina. And it seems like she has a lead everywhere else. Can Bernie Sanders survive a defeat in New Hampshire? Has his people have his people talked about that at all?
Well, I think they feel he better win New Hampshire, I think, is what they're focusing on. And, you know, they believe that they've, you know, done the work that could allow that to happen. But it is hard to see once this race, you know, heads to the South, you know, that's going to be a field on which he's going to be able to compete with Hillary Clinton. I mean, right now, you know, we have 7 weeks. All the candidates are focused on just making sure that their vote turns out. And, you know, this is going to be close on the Democratic side. I mean, a lot of people assume that the suspense in New Hampshire is going to be on the GOP side. But, you know, if you believe the polls, Donald Trump's going to win New Hampshire in a walk. I'm not sure that's going to happen. But, you know, certainly the Democratic race has turned out to be the more competitive day in and day out.
Well, let's go to the Republicans for a second. As you say, I mean, Donald Trump definitely leads the pack nationally. And Ted Cruz now seems to be the candidate to beat in Iowa. So for nearly everyone else, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, John Kasich, New Hampshire seems to be a must-win state. And, of course, they can't all win it. So how are the Republican candidates doing?
Well, if you look at the polls here, it is pretty remarkable that Donald Trump has led every New Hampshire poll since mid-June, and most of the recent ones by at least a dozen points. And, you know, after Trump, you have this kind of clot of candidates, you know, most of the fellows you name, Cruz, Christie, Rubio, and Bush, you know, in no particular order, although I guess Bush tends to be at the end of the line at this point. This state is obviously a must win for, you know, people running, you know, in the so-called establishment bracket of the primary. It's obvious if you spend time with Chris Christie that he's picked up some steam here. I was out with him over the weekend, and he has reached out to lots of activists in the party, courted, you know, the umpteen state reps that are here, you know, really sort of personally campaigned and lobbied all these folks. And that seems to be helping him. The union leader endorsement helps him a bit. Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, who are, you know, about the same place in the polls as Christie, they haven't been here very much. It's an open question as to what sort of ground game they have here. Cruz is certainly popular with the real conservatives. Rubio, a lot of people say, oh, he's everybody's second choice and some people's first choice, but it is unclear if he's put in the time to win people over. Kasich, after a lot of spending by his super PAC, you know, he bumped up at the beginning of this race, and he's, you know, won a lot of the sort of core establishment supporters who a lot of people assumed would have gone with Jeb Bush. That may help him. It's hard to find many hardcore Republican activists, though, who are terribly excited about either Kasich or Bush. So it's hard to know who's going to break out of the non-Trump category.
Well, the latest poll I saw was from CBS News, and in New Hampshire it had Trump 32, Cruz 14, Rubio 13, Christie 11, then Kasich 8 and Bush 6, and the rest even worse. So it seems like the battle here, battle in New Hampshire, is for second place.
Well, based on the polls, certainly. It is hard for a lot of people here in New Hampshire to kind of get their heads around the idea that, you know, in somebody like Trump, you could have someone win the New Hampshire primary who may have never actually spent the night in New Hampshire after campaigning, does one campaign stop a day, and has largely done it in large rallies. And, I mean, I guess it's a good thing if you can pull that off, but we'll see. Certainly, based on the polls, it would be foolish to expect Trump not to win at this point. But there is time, and, you know, everyone's been trying to drag Trump down. I mean, Bush called Trump a jerk over the weekend. It's unclear at this point whether if he's thinking, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to win this thing, so I may as well go down swinging at Trump. But obviously, lots of people have tried to and failed to drag down Trump.
There's an old saying that New Hampshire voters, probably like Iowa's as well, they make their decisions at the last minute. So you think someone else can win this thing other than Trump with 7 weeks to go?
I think it's possible. I think that a lot of people are looking at, you know, it's possible that somebody like Rubio, you do talk to voters, you go to his events, there's a great deal of excitement. I mean, I guess I would say I'm waiting to see whether, you know, he puts in the time here. You can certainly feel that Chris Christie, you go to his events, and, you know, I'm not sure I would expect him to win, but you can definitely feel energy in the room. He's enjoying his time campaigning here, and when you go to his events, at the end of the event, even the longer ones, there are voters who are pushing up to get close to him. And that's not going on with a lot of the other candidates. You know, Trump is hard to figure, though.
The next debates don't come until mid-January. And with the holidays coming up, do you expect the race in both parties to be frozen until then?
Hard to say. I mean, people tend to focus a little bit in Iowa after the holiday, but it's been a few cycles since the primary was actually this late. The last two times it was in early January. So there is a little bit more time. And if you talk to the campaigns that aren't in the lead, they all say, well, you know, this is a little different. People are really going to start to focus and winnow this thing after the new year. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, there is going to be a few weeks where, you know, voters are really going to be able to pay attention without the distractions of the holidays. That hasn't been the case for several cycles.
Josh Rogers is a senior political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. He's on Twitter at Josh Rogers NHPR. Josh, it was great talking to you again.
Thanks, Ken.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question, which was, of all the mayors from New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Philadelphia, who was the last to resign while in the midst of an ethics investigation? The answer, William O'Dwyer of New York in 1950. A police scandal and questions about his association with mob figures forced him out on August 31st, 1950. That didn't keep President Truman from naming him ambassador to Mexico. And the randomly selected winner is Marshall Solomon of Chicago. Marshall wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttlebutt winner as well. Scuttlebutt, as you may know, is that weekly waste of time exercise where I post a vertical sequence of campaign buttons, and your job is to take one word or concept per button and add them up to arrive at a famous name or familiar expression someone from Earth would recognize. Last week's puzzle started with a picture button of Yasser Arafat, the late leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Then a button that read, "That's entertainment." One that said, "My God is alive, sorry about yours." And one that said, "Don't call me baby, honey, or girl, call me governor." Ah, these feminists. Anyway, so when you combine Yasser plus that plus my plus baby, you kind of get Yasser, That's My Baby, a song from 1925 and a movie from 1949. And no, sir, I don't mean maybe. The winner is Rob McCauley of Burlington, Ontario, Canada, which is a separate country. There's a new scuttlebutt puzzle up on our website, along with a lot of other fun stuff. They're all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
That's my baby. No, sir, I don't mean maybe. Yes, sir, that's my baby now. Yes, ma'am, we've decided. No, ma'am, we ain't gonna hide it. Yes, ma'am, you're invited now.
It's time for This Week in Political History. He wasn't supposed to ever be a heartbeat away from the presidency.
I proudly present to you the man whose name I will submit to the Congress of the United States for confirmation as the Vice President of the United States, Congressman Gerald Ford of Michigan.
Or even President himself.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
Scandal elevated Gerald Ford, the congressman from Grand Rapids, Michigan, since 1949, to first the vice presidency in 1973, and then the presidency 8 months later. In a bid for a full term in 1976, he was narrowly defeated by Jimmy Carter, a former governor of Georgia. Ford served in the White House for 2 years, 5 months, and 12 days. Only four presidents had a shorter tenure. And he died 9 years ago this week. President George W. Bush made the announcement.
President Ford lived 93 years, and his life was a blessing to America. And now this fine man will be taken to his rest by a family that will love him always, and by a nation that will be grateful to him forever. May God bless Gerald Ford.
Richard Norton Smith is a presidential historian and one of the great biographers of our time. He has written wonderful biographies of Thomas Dewey, Herbert Hoover, and Colonel Robert McCormick, the New Deal opponent who owned the Chicago Tribune. He has also written a biography of Nelson Rockefeller, which I have not yet read, but it's on my Christmas wish list. And now he's working on a biography of Gerald Ford. Richard Norton Smith, welcome to The Political Junkie.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ford served for only 2+ years as president, but when he came into office, it was a very critical time for the country, a country that was weary over the whole Watergate scandal.
You know, if you weren't around, it's hard to recapture. One of the challenges, obviously, as a biographer that I confront is doing just that, a sense of genuine constitutional crisis. I mean, this country had not been through, I think, a worse situation. We'd obviously had the Great Depression. But in terms of a political crisis, since the Civil War, and here was Gerald Ford, in some ways a very unlikely candidate to address this. Yes, he'd been vice president for 10 months. Yes, he'd been on the Hill for 25 years. But he was still really very largely unknown to the American people. But again, one of the remarkable things about that time, as opposed to this, was how different, how genuinely, constructively, in many ways bipartisan, Congress could be.
Well, that's a good point. Well, that day when Nixon nominated Ford to replace Spiro Agnew as his vice president, he said that Ford was widely respected by members of both parties. That was true, wasn't it?
That was true. Classic example, Hale Boggs, who was his Democratic counterpart, majority leader of the House, they used to debate down at the National Press Club. And guess what the debates were? They get in a car, they drive down, and they decide on the way what they were going to debate that day. They'd have lunch, they'd have the debate, and then they'd go out and have a drink, probably two drinks, and go back, you know, beat up on each other until 6 o'clock, and then were the best of friends. It was a very different political culture.
Yeah, that was what Congress was like. They would battle each other on the floor of the House and then afterwards open up a drawer in their office and open up a bottle.
It was also more of a consensus country. Remember, the Cold War tended to bring us together in a way, to focus our energies in a way that almost nothing else could. We had a whole generation that had been through the Depression, that had been through World War II, and now we're going through the Cold War. And I think that's something that we miss today. I'm not suggesting we want to repeat that. What I'm saying is the shared experience, whether you were right or left, Republican or Democrat, of going through those national tests, I think that created a different kind of political culture than what we have today.
And when you think of all the agony and the stuff that we all went through during the Watergate scandal, when Nixon resigned and he came into office, Americans breathed a sigh of relief. But we'll talk about that for a second. I mean, he was the right man at the right time.
Ford came into office, and there was what you could only call euphoria. And it wasn't necessarily for anything that Ford had done. It was simply because, as he said, our long national nightmare is over. Americans were just glad to have Watergate, they thought, behind them. But, of course, our long national nightmare was not over. Ford, at his first press conference, to his surprise, was bombarded with questions about Richard Nixon and his papers and his tapes and his legal standing. And he came out of that press conference, I think, having decided the only way to put an end to those questions, and more important, the obsession the country had with Richard Nixon, was to pardon him, to get him off the president's desk so the new president could turn his attention to the economy and the Middle East and a whole range of problems that, frankly, were being neglected.
And here is that tape.
I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed or taken part in during the period from July 20, 1969 through August 9, 1974.
Did Gerry Ford lose the country right then and there?
Lose the country, I think, is going too far. We know overnight his popularity poll dropped 29 points, and that is unprecedented. So, yeah, I mean, he lost something that he was never able to regain. The fact is, he came very close, against the odds, to winning a full term. On the other hand, you could also say he didn't cross that final threshold of victory because there were still just enough people who had not forgiven him, if you will, for the pardon. You could argue it either way. Fortunately, he lived long enough to see public opinion shift dramatically his way. And one of the great days of his life came in 2000 when the Kennedy Library, led by Senator Kennedy, Caroline Kennedy, presented him with the Profiles in Courage Award explicitly for the Nixon pardon. I mean, it was an amazing turnaround, if you will. And so he lived out his life convinced that he had done the right thing, and almost as important, that most Americans had come to agree.
Aside from the pardon, he also had other worries. South Vietnam fell to the communists, right? Unemployment?
Well, stagflation. That was a brand new term. Traditionally, the governments fought unemployment or they fought inflation. You didn't fight both because they were mutually exclusive, not in the Ford years. Terrorism. You know, anyone who thinks terrorism is something that began overnight, I mean, it really has its origins in the 1970s. Turmoil in the Middle East never seems to change. The energy crisis really first engaged our attention in the 70s. One of the remarkable things about the Ford years, first of all, is they were much more eventful than we think. But secondly, they're much more contemporary in the issues that Ford had to deal with than we generally think.
He also, you were talking about his preparing for his election bid in 1976. He also didn't have the best debate performances against Jimmy Carter.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and there never will be under a Ford administration.
And his running mate, Bob Dole, didn't make things much better.
I figured up the other day, if we added up the killed and wounded, in Democrat wars in this century would be about 1.6 million Americans, enough to fill the city of Detroit.
Here's the difference between journalism and history. The fact of the matter is, you can take two quips out of the debate. And the fact is, at the time, the immediate polling response was, believe it or not, that the president had actually won that debate. He had already won the first debate, according to the polls. Remember, Gerald Ford went into the fall campaign trailing by 30 points. He lost by two. So he did something right, you know, along the way. And you're absolutely right. What happened with the Polish gaffe was he was very stubborn. He wouldn't admit. It took almost a week to finally get him to cast it in different phrasing. But you see, he'd been to Poland. He'd been to Romania. He had seen the looks on people's faces. He had felt their underlying, overwhelming desire to be free. And in some ways, he was just a decade or two ahead of his time.
Well, I mean, we know what he meant. He meant that the people in the Eastern Bloc don't consider themselves so under the Soviet domination. But
you're right. He never fully grasped that a president's words mean infinitely more than a congressman's words. And the problem, of course, was it fed the stereotype that had come from Saturday Night Live and other sources, that this man, nice man, but is he really up to the presidency?
Couldn't walk and chew gum, right?
That was the problem, you know, really. Less what he said, than the image that it reinforced.
When he was rejected for another term, how did he handle that?
You know, he said one of the great things about, you know, he'd been a competitive athlete, great football player in his early days, and he, one of the things he learned very early on was you play as hard as you can within the rules to win, but, you know, the fact is you can't win all the time. And he'd learned very early, and in effect, how to deal with defeat. Now, it was difficult. It was very difficult because they had come so far, so fast. I mean, obviously, on election day, every candidate thinks they're going to win. But Ford really had reason to believe that the momentum, you know, the very last poll, the Gallup poll, had him up by 1 point. And so it was painful, and it took him a while to get over it. But he also was he was not someone who lived in the past. He was always looking ahead. Mrs. Ford, you know, encouraged that. And they were looking, you know, he was going to retire that year anyway. He had made a promise to her. He was going to leave the House of Representatives, and they were going to leave Washington after 25 years. So one way or the other, they were planning on being out of D.C. in 77. Not that they wouldn't have liked to stay for another 4 years. But they started a new life out in California, and the time was good to them.
How do you think the nation will remember Gerald Ford?
You know, it's a good question. I think the most obvious thing is how he thought he would be remembered, which is as the man who came into office amidst incredibly difficult, even tumultuous circumstances, and over time did a lot to restore public confidence in the very system that had produced him. If you think about the mood of America in the summer of 1974 and the mood in the summer of 1976 when we celebrated our bicentennial, that, I think, tells you probably a lot about how he will be remembered.
Richard Norton Smith is a presidential historian and a biographer who is working on a biography of Gerald Ford. His most recent book is On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller. Richard, thanks so much for being on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It was 9 years ago this week, on December 26, 2006, that Gerald Ford, the 38th President of the United States, died at the age of 93. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. Before we go, in our annual Remembrances special, we touched upon some of the major characters in the world of politics who passed from the scene this year. One of them was Arch Moore, who served 3 terms as governor of West Virginia, at a time when the state was still a solid Democratic stronghold. Moore served longer than any other governor in state history, and he wasn't the last person in his family to make history. His daughter, Shelley Moore Capito, was elected to the Senate from West Virginia in 2014, the first Republican to win a Senate seat there since 1956, and the first woman to do so ever. And she is the first female senator from West Virginia to ever appear on The Political Junkie. Senator Capito, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be on.
In all the notices I read after your dad died, I kept seeing the words like folksy and rascal and charismatic. He was all those and more, wasn't he?
He really was. He was a force to be reckoned with. He had a lot of passion for what he did, but he was also a rascal. I think that would be good. He was a character.
And he was a legendary campaigner, wasn't he? I mean, I always read that he always made sure to shake everybody's hand. He remembered everybody's names.
In West Virginia, he is known for his ability to know everybody's names. People who wouldn't see him for 2 or 3 years in a different place, he would always identify them. He had such a gift, and he knew how important it was to people that you would remember them, that you would remember their name. And he always taught me, and I think the rest of our family, that no matter who you're talking to, whether it was the Pope or the guy, you know, parking your car, you treat everybody the same and give them the same respect. And I think that came through in his campaigning, and he loved to campaign. He just loved it.
Arch Moore was elected to Congress in 1956, and then he was first elected governor in 1968. This was years before people voted Republican in West Virginia. How did he do it?
Well, he took care of people. When he was a congressman, he made sure that, and I get these stories today. I met a woman several months ago who told me that he helped her immigrate to the United States because back then you could only bring two kids and she was the third child. And so he made sure she got to Wheeling to reunite with her family. I've met people who sons were in Vietnam and they couldn't find out, you know, how they were and lost contact with them, hadn't heard from them in a while. And dad was right on it, you know, with the Department of Defense, making sure that, you know, their son was okay. He just took care of people. And, you know, they can discard party labels even back then, as long as they knew they felt you cared about them and that your heart was in the right place.
Well, here he is announcing his candidacy in 1967.
With the encouragement of my wife and children, and with the best wishes of my family and friends, and with the sincere hope that the people of the 1st Congressional District trust my judgment in this matter, I will file for the Republican nomination for governor of the state of West Virginia.
So he wins in 1968, and he's reelected 4 years later, defeating some guy named John D. Rockefeller IV.
Right.
Jay Rockefeller had the backing of the labor unions, of Senator Robert Byrd. He had a ton of money, most of it his own, and yet your dad won. How do you do that?
Well, you know, he was also the first governor to ever succeed himself, because in 1970, West Virginia changed the law that said a governor could run for consecutive terms. So, you know, dad was on a roll. And, you know, when you play that clip and I hear it, my, he had such a forceful speaking voice, which is great when he's speaking. When you're his child, maybe not so great if you're not doing the right thing. But I think at that point, Jay was new to the state. People were unsure about him. And dad just rolled him. I mean, he just really did. He just out-campaigned him. He worked harder. And, you know, he was a successful governor in his first term. And I think he was rewarded for that.
So he serves two terms back to back. He couldn't run for a third term, but what were some of your dad's greatest accomplishments? I know a lot of building of new schools, interstate highways, things like that, I know, right?
Well, right. He instituted kindergarten in West Virginia. He gave teachers the first pay raise they'd had in a decade. He built a lot of roads. He built a lot of libraries. He had this concept of sort of little pod libraries all around the state that are just now, some of them, you know, they're pretty old right now. They're just finally going away. He reformed the welfare system in West Virginia. He did a lot of economic development issues. He was really sort of into everything. But I think his years as a congressman really maximized his effectiveness as a governor, because he could work with then Nixon administration. He knew how to work Washington. And he was able to really bring home some good federal dollars into the state.
I know he couldn't run because of term limits again in 1976, but I have a campaign button that says Archmore for President in 76. Was that serious at all?
You know, I have one of those buttons, too, and I kind of look at it. I kind of have it hanging in the house somewhere, and I look at it every now and then. I think, how serious was that? I mean, I'm sure he was serious in his own mind, but, you know, he was really good friends with Gerald Ford because they had served in Congress, and actually, in the 1976 convention, when it was so heated between Ford and Reagan, West Virginia, with dad's voice at the microphone, was the one who put Gerald Ford back into that nomination for president. So I don't really think he was all that serious, but he would have loved it.
It's a great button.
It is a good button.
So he ran again in 1980 against Jay Rockefeller, and who had now become governor. And I remember that great bumper sticker during the campaign, "Make him spend it all, Arch." I love that.
Right. He made Jay spend a lot of money, but Jay got the better of him in that one for sure.
And then he comes back in 1984, and he's endorsed by the West Virginia Education Association. Those labor unions don't usually endorse Republicans.
No, and I think it was because he really had spent a lot of his years as governor paying attention to teachers and making them, you know their worth and all that. He would never be where he was if he had not been the beneficiary of the GI Bill, had gotten a good education. So he always put a strong value on that.
I can't talk about his career without mentioning the ethics problems he had after he left the governorship. He was convicted of corruption charges. He went to prison. What did that do to him?
You know, obviously, a really difficult time for him, particularly for my mother. Really tough on the family. You know, it was hard. I think he had many regrets, but, you know, he always had this incredible ability to keep looking forward. And I think even during those really tough times for him and for us and for my mother, he was able to just keep looking forward. I'm sure that if he could have rewritten his history, he would have liked to eliminate that chapter. And he probably tried to do that a few times with some biographers. But, you know, that's part of who he was. And we made it through it, made it stronger, closer as a family. But, you know, definitely was difficult in terms of, you know, obviously I talked about what a great legacy he had. It's hard to have that tacked on at the very end.
He lived to see you get elected to the Senate. Was he active in the campaign at all? Or,
you know, unfortunately, the last couple of years, my parents were in very ill health, both with dementia. But what was really uncanny about the whole thing was I left West Virginia to go be sworn in as a senator. I knew he wasn't doing well. My mother had passed away like 3 months before. And I was talking constantly with the nurses, and I was just like, please tell him to hang on one more day, and I'll be darned if he didn't. He hung on one more day, and I was able to get back after I got sworn in, and my brother and sister and I were there with him when he passed away.
I want to go back to that press conference he gave in 1967 when he announced his candidacy for governor. I want to play one more piece of tape.
I would like for you to meet, and I would like to present to the people of West Virginia my wife and three children. And have you meet the Archmore family.
In that old film clip, there's a 14-year-old girl named Shelley who's introduced. Do you remember that day?
I do remember that day because, you know, the times were so few and far between. You're standing there with TV and have your hair all done and you're ready to go. Yes, I do remember that day.
You had that Mary Tyler Moore hairdo.
I did. I was going for some kind of a look there. I don't know how I got my hair to do that.
You also attended John F. Kennedy's funeral with your dad. Now, West Virginia, we know, was very important to President Kennedy. Did he have any relationship with your dad?
You know, he did, because Dad was in Congress when President Kennedy was serving. And one of the funny stories was in 1962, there had been a redistricting in West Virginia where we were losing a congressional seat. And my father, as the new congressman and the only Republican, got redistricted with the venerated senior member of Congress, a guy named Cleve Bailey, who had been in forever. And Kennedy was going to come in and campaign for Cleve in Wheeling, which is my dad's hometown. And Kennedy gets up on the stand. It's raining. There are thousands of people there. And he says, I'm here to tell you, in his Boston accent, I'm here to tell you that you need to reelect Arch Moore. He said my dad's name. And the crowd just goes, And so, but they had just worked on something just previous to that. Like Dad said, like maybe the week before they had talked on the phone. And so I don't know if Kennedy did it on purpose. I kind of doubt it, but he had Dad on his mind. And it became sort of a famous story. Hugh Seide wrote about it, you know, who used to write for Time magazine.
What did Arch Moore mean to West Virginia?
You know, my dad had a vision for the state. He loved West Virginia. I mean, that's where his heart was. And he always felt that we didn't ever realize or try to realize our full potential. And that's what he kept doing with his aggressive moves. He was a very aggressive person, and he wasn't afraid to make a mistake. He created the Marshall Medical School, the West Virginia School of Osteopathic Medicine. He knew education was the key to moving West Virginia forward. So, you know, I think if people look back on him, they think leadership, energy, risk taker, and just a ball of fire.
Shelley Moore Capito is a Republican from West Virginia. She served 7 terms in the House before being elected to the Senate in 2014. And she's the daughter of Arch Moore Jr., the former 3-term governor who died last January. Senator Capito, thank you so much for sharing your memories of your dad.
Thank you, and thank you for honoring him.
Almost heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life is old there, older than the trees, younger than the mountains, growing like a breeze. Country roads, take me home to the place I belong. West Virginia, mountain mama, take me home. Country roads.
That's it for this week's show. And that's it for us this year. Political Junkie is made possible with support from WAMU here in Washington and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. We're taking a break over the holidays, but we'll be back in January, gearing up for a new year chock full of caucuses, primaries, debates, and conventions. In the meantime, continue to check out our website for our political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt puzzles, and bad jokes. All at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And thank you to all of you who continue to support the show. We couldn't manage without your help, financial and spiritual. Especially financial. If you're feeling that festive giving spirit, go to our homepage and click that green donate button on the right side. Once again, it's at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Our show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer, and Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays. We'll see you next year.
Country roads, take me home to the place. Take me home.